Welcome back, everybody, and welcome if you're just joining me. My name's Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Big thanks to my last guest, Kyle Ross of the Center for American Progress Action Fund. Folks, if you need to find a food pantry near you, you can go to foodfinder.us. That is foodfinder.us. You just plunk in your zip code, and it will direct you to food pantries near you. In case anybody you know, and I guarantee you there are people that you know that are very concerned about their SNAP benefits. Right now, I have been very much looking forward to having this discussion with Dr. Craig Spencer. He's an associate professor on the practice of health services, policy and practice at the Brown University School of Public Health. Thank you so much for being here, Dr. Craig. It's such an important discussion. We will have you back to talk about public health, what it is and what it isn't, and why misinformation is a problem. But you were interviewed by the Daily Beast a few weeks ago, and I have looked at it just in my own, trying to remain a well-versed person, especially doing what I do now. Yeah. I have spent some time looking at the history of eugenics in the United States, its modeling by the Nazi movement, the Third Reich in Germany, and some of the echoes that we hear today in the rhetoric, but also in the policy objectives coming out of the Trump administration. You spoke about this on the record very clearly to the Daily Beast. Help people understand. Let's just set the table. Tell us a little bit about the catalyst for the eugenics movement in the United States and how it was deployed to basically come up with a race-based class system here.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on this. I've been talking a lot about this. This was not what I thought I would be chatting the most on when I started teaching on the history of public health. I thought it was going to be the boring stuff. But the more I learned about eugenics, the more I realized it was unfolding in front of us every single day, particularly over the past, you know, 7 or 8 months. But let me situate us. And again, thank you, Maggie, for having me on to chat about this. When we talk about eugenics today, well, we just don't talk about eugenics, right? If anybody knows about it, they know that it was probably bad. And I hear pseudoscience, and I hear that it was part of the Nazis. And that's something that we don't do. But the problem is that overlooks the fact that 100 years ago, the overwhelming majority of Americans not only knew about eugenics, but were strong adherents to its practices, including in medicine, including in public health, including in law on the Supreme Court, and we'll talk about that. But let's go a little bit further back. And to kind of understand, you need to know that in the mid-1800s, you had Charles Darwin that came up with this whole idea about evolution and completely changed the way people thought about society. And a few decades later, his cousin, Galton, Francis Galton, came up with this idea of eugenics. He coined the term, and it meant well-born from the Greek well-born. And he was convinced that we could improve society by improving heredity, by changing who breeds and who breeds with whom, who has kids, what are the good stock, and kind of like how we've thought about cattle or animals for, you know, a long time, we should do the same for humans. And he came up with this idea about positive eugenics, where we get the wealthy and the well-educated and the, quote, good stock to have more kids. And we prevent the bad stock, generally the poor, the people of color, from having more kids. And this was a movement that, again, I cannot overstate how impactful it was for policy and health and medicine and nearly everything 100 years ago. It was everywhere. It was part of our immigration policy. It was part of our reproductive policy. And that's, I hope, just a way to set the stage to let people know that even though we don't talk about it a lot today, doesn't mean that it didn't exist. It existed and it was everywhere.
And it was everywhere in our medical systems, in our government, in our legal system. It was used to effectively deprive rights to groups of people that were deemed undesirable. Mm-hmm. And of course, that was not coincidentally. It was specifically designed, this fake nonsense invented out of thin air that had no true scientific basis, to basically say to black and brown folks and poor white people as well,
for sure,
you are the unwashed, you are the undesirables, and we are going to create systems to basically exile you from mainstream social, economic, religious, medical, and legal systems. That is the design of eugenics. Tell us a little bit about why and how that showed up, if you can just cite a couple of examples of where that showed up, and then we'll get into why the Nazis used it as effectively a blueprint for the Nuremberg laws and racial segregation.
Absolutely. So really in the late 1800s, it started picking up steam. And in the early 1900s, it really kind of came to a head. And it was in medicine, it was in health, it was in policy. One of the kind of earliest pushes by the eugenics movement was to try and restrict immigration. And in the early 1900s, as a lot of people know, a lot of people were coming to the United States from all over the world. You know, we had on Ellis Island, the Statue of Liberty put up. We had in the Lower East Side in New York, we had, you know, massive populations of people from all over the world that were showing up and spreading across the country. And there were concerns that we had too many people and they were lower stock and people were sending their worst, and that we had to do something about it, that we needed fewer of these people from like Southern Italy or these Irish Catholics that were coming in way too high of numbers. We needed to keep them out. And what happened was there was a group largely led by, you know, really wealthy folks in Boston and others that tried to put in place literacy tests or tried to put in place other restrictions through legislative action, through laws that ended up getting into the Supreme Court, that got into the halls of power, into Congress and into the Senate. And the result was two big immigration bills, one in 1917 and then a more restrictive one in 1924 called the Johnson-Reed Act. And what it did is it said, we're going to go back to what the country looked like in 1890, and we are going to restrict the number of people that can come from any country in the world to about 2% of the people that came in at that time. And so this was a way to dramatically slash the number of people coming into the U.S. It set up a quota system. And I'd be remiss to not mention that it was decades before even this that the Chinese Exclusion Act was put into place, after a lot of Chinese migrant laborers helped build the Transcontinental Railroad, to basically stop migration from China for decades, up until World War II. And in the aftermath of the 1924 Johnson-Reed Act that was pushed by eugenicists, we should know that at that time, Calvin Coolidge was in the White House and many other people who had pushed the eugenics movement, including Teddy Roosevelt, many of our early presidents, many of our early leaders.
The Carnegie Institution, the Rockefeller
absolutely.
Foundation.
Rockefeller Foundation. Yep. Yeah, exactly. There was a lot of money that went into this. And the Johnson-Reed Act in 1924 slashed immigration, and that stayed in place for 40 years. The other thing, in the other place where the eugenics showed up, was in a lot of the progressive era health policy. So now we hear a lot of talk about food, and we hear a lot of talk about clean water, all of those things that are important now as they were 100 years ago. A lot of people might know that, you know, Kellogg, the guy who created cornflakes, was really big into health and eugenics. And you might hear these small stories, but the really big story was that in the 19-teens and 1920s, a lot of states started putting in place legislation that would allow them to forcibly sterilize primarily women of color or poor women. And this got to a point where the Supreme Court had to wade in. And in 1927, they discussed a case, this woman, Buck v. Bell. This was a Supreme Court case that was decided and written by the famously progressive Oliver Wendell Holmes. And in the decision, they said three generations of imbeciles is enough, and basically used a public health justification to say the state should be allowed to sterilize people against their will if they have mental illness, if they're feeble-minded. And that's what happened for decades, until the 70s in many places, and even until the early 2000s in places like California. So the big takeaway that I want people to know about this is not that this was just a really big thing in health and reproduction and immigration and economics everywhere. It's that it was huge, and even after we rejected it, we said that the Nazis did this, they learned this from the U.S. Hitler apparently told Madison Grant, who wrote the 1916 book, basically, you know, outlining the Great Replacement
Theory. The passing
theory,
of the Great Race.
The passing of the
that
Great
is
Race.
The replacement theory. Yep.
That was the replacement theory. And Hitler apparently said, you know, that book was his, quote, Bible.
His Bible. Yep.
And so in the late 1920s and late 1930s, there was a lot of connection between the U.S. and in Germany. Germany looked to the United States to try to look at how you put in place legislation and laws to forcibly sterilize people, which Germany did, obviously, in the 30s. And so the point is not that this was everywhere or that it was really bad and the Germanys adopted it and we've kind of forgotten about it. It's also that the impact of these policies lasted for a very, very, very long time. For decades when it came to immigration, that was not overturned until Lyndon Johnson in the mid-60s. For decades when it came to reproductive control, particularly for women of color, these have long-term impacts. And so when we talk about the repercussions, you can say, maybe we have an administration in place that's using some of these policies, but we can turn them off when we have a different administration in office. And the reality is that it's not that easy. It's not that easy, and history has shown us that it's not that easy.
It's not that easy. Folks, we're talking with Dr. Craig Spencer. He's a professor of public health history at Brown University. I just want to summarize here. We saw this in immigration policy.
Yeah.
Today, there were headlines. Donald Trump is limiting refugees to the lowest level in like 30 years, 7,500 a year. And guess who they all are? White Afrikaners. Like literally the folks that benefited from a racially based apartheid regime in South Africa. Like that's who we're going to take as refugees. Okay,
great. Well, the other group, to be fair, there's another group that has been targeted for prioritization, and it is members of the German AfD party,
yes,
which is a party that has been accused of that has used neo-Nazi slogans. And this is a party that this administration has buddied up to, has said is being unfairly criticized. And so when I see people post on Twitter or talk about the fact that this administration wants to cut down refugees and that they want to prioritize white South Africans, they call it racism. This is not just racism. This is eugenics in 2025. It is this idea that we can and choose the populations that we want to breed. It's similar to Elon Musk talking about and acting on this desire to increase the number of people. That depopulation, he says, is the greatest civilizational concern. He's not concerned about depopulation in South Africa. If he was, he would be having babies with a bunch of people in South Africa, where he is from, right? What he's doing is he's having a bunch of babies and trying to increase the headcount that is related to him. He's trying to do what Galton told him to do. And this is incredibly problematic.
Incredibly problematic. You hear this in a bunch of these sort of billionaire technocrat oligarchs and this weird intersection of this ethno-nationalistic Christian white-centric plus AI version of the future. I mean, Elon Musk has how many kids? Like 13, 14? We're going to come back with Dr. Craig Spencer and continue to dig into this. Do not go anywhere, everybody. This discussion of modern eugenics in the Trump administration continues on the other side. I'm Maggie Dawn. You are listening to the Civic Media Radio Network.